Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Anybody who believes we live in a democratic society today needs to go to a recent study released by Princeton University that says the United States is no longer ruled by a democratic process. It is ruled by an oligarchy or by corporations.
Stating the shocking reality that has now become common understanding pretty much all over the world, Ellen's guest today is Roger Landry, an outspoken critic and observer of events that we find ourselves in, locked into a seemingly permanent financial trap with our common assets in too few hands. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen Brown's co-host for this show, and today we're going to be talking about how big money is grabbing one of our most critical common assets, water. Roger will be giving you some provocative notions about how that unfolding crisis around water is occurring, perhaps most noticeably these days in California. Water is the new oil. Later in our program, we'll be getting an update on some of the new developments underway in the public banking frontier. Commentary from Matt Stannard on why the big banks are pushing back against the rise of American public banks, and some comic relief from the one and only George Carlin. But now, let's turn to Ellen.
Ellen, this week your new article is called California Water Wars, Another Form of Asset Stripping. And it's a very timely topic, not only because of some of this news coming out of California about the prospect of very short-lived water resources, but because of some of the way water has been played as a financial commodity just in the last year, the way it's been played in Detroit to keep water away from people who can't afford it. Fracking companies are now suing small little towns like Barnville, Ohio, because its agreement with the gas and oil industry was unable to keep that because it didn't have enough water in its reservoir, and now they're being sued by this, you know, $400 million company. So what are we looking at here with this water war business, Ellen?
Well, if you want to get highly suspicious about it, the water is considered, it has been called the next big commodity. It's supposed to surpass oil. I mean, obviously, you need water even more than you need oil, and its resources are scarce. In California, which is what I was just writing about, there's only 1 year left in the reservoirs, and they don't really have a backup plan for where to get the water. So what I was writing about was, first of all, that there are alternatives that they're not exploring, and that's actually what prompted me to write this article, was I knew about primary water, which is water springing from the rocks. It's like water springing from nowhere in the desert. When you see these oases in the desert with suddenly there's water and there's no place around where there was rainfall that it could have collected, it actually comes up from the Middle Earth, and there's new research showing that there could be up to five times as much water under the surface of the Earth as there is on the top. But then of course, what interests me is the, like you say, what does that mean? Why are they not developing in that, and what are they doing? It looks like what they're doing is like they did in the old movies about the water wars, where they're always fighting over water rights, and it's kind of like keeping the money scarce so that they can make us borrow it. Like if there was plenty of money, if they did quantitative easing so for the people that actually got out there into the economy, we wouldn't need to be borrowing so much, but they want us to borrow. So they want to keep money tight. Well, if they keep water tight, it's the same deal. Then we have to buy their bottled water.
They control another commodity market, just like they control oil and aluminum and coal and all of the other things in a monopolized fashion. In the instance of the California, the only project that that I believe you reported in your article was the that's on the books is the the Delta Water Tunnel Project, which has got a cost of $60 billion, and that's when you include the financing costs, right, which may well be, what, half as much.
Right. The initial costs were, I think it was $24 billion or something like that, but by the time you add in financing, it's actually more than doubled. So a bit shocking. And that's all they've got, which is just fighting between the North and the South, or between the farmers and the or one set of farmers and another set of farmers. So it's not really expanding the money supply, or sorry, the water supply.
But what
you could do is there's desalination. I was just talking to somebody from Dubai. Apparently that's where they get their water. They desalinate.
And the Israelis are very, very successful at that.
Yeah. And we've got like miles and miles, thousands of miles of coastline. So... hundreds of miles.
Seven or eight hundred miles,
anyway.
Yeah, you report that this, you know, in this commodity boom, that one writer, Christina Sarich from Nation of Change, reported that numerous companies are poised to take advantage of this water crisis. And instead of protecting the existing supplies, they're implementing stricter regulations and coming up with novel ways to capture the rainwater or desalinizing, as you pointed out, seawater. The corporate agenda is ready like a snake coiled to make trillions off of our thirst. And I just want to say you also then quoted the United Nations as being really right in the middle of it in their environment program of 2007, describing a water for profit scheme that actively promotes the privatization and monopolization of the world's water supplies by multinational corporations. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
You know,
Monsanto is developing seeds that are drought resistant and aluminum resistant. Now, you might ask, why aluminum? Aluminum is what they're dropping out from the skies to do this geoengineering, popularly called chemtrails, which is controversial. But anyway, you know, why else do you need aluminum resistant seeds if you're not combating aluminum? So supposedly they're doing that to prevent global warming or to cool the earth, to put this whole shield around the earth of these materials they're dropping in the air from airplanes. And there's more and more experts are actually admitting that that's what they're doing.
That's been going on for a while, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, over a decade, depending on who you read. But yeah.
But there are these really creative and scientifically proven new alternatives available. What is it going to take for these things to be implemented? I mean, MIT can do a study and devise a theory and a practical example, but how can we realize those things as citizens in a country?
Well, that one, on a national level, what they should do, it seems to me, is use quantitative easing to fund infrastructure, and there have been proposals like that. But on a state level, assuming they're not going to do that, which I don't see them really moving in that direction, on a state level, we can set up publicly owned banks, which can... California is facing a $600 billion infrastructure bill over the next decade, and if you add in interest, it's liable to be double that. So where are they going to get the money? If you borrow from yourself, A, you don't have to pay interest, and so you save 50% on the cost of infrastructure if you borrow from your own publicly owned bank. And B, you could arguably just keep rolling those loans over. You know, you don't necessarily have to pay them back. We've rolled over the national debt ever since 1835, and we haven't gone down yet. So that, of course, that would be our preferred solution in the Public Banking Institute is publicly owned banks.
Yeah. Now, the global banks are playing in markets all over the world, and water is one of the commodities that they're focusing on, right? The monopoly, the ability to control that, a huge assumption or assertion of power.
Right, and they're buying massive areas of land that have these water rights underneath, have water underneath them. So either you're going to have a battle where the national governments, I'm thinking like in Central America and South America, the Amazon and so forth, either we're going to have a battle over the nation will nationalize their water resources, and then, of course, the our people, our corporations will come in and try to sue them under the TPP or something, or people are just going to have to go without water. I mean, here you have people getting sued for collecting rainwater on their roofs because all the water supposedly belongs to the
really?
Big landlords.
Really? And people are getting sued for having cisterns? Roof
that
water?
Was happening in, was it, was one of those South American countries, and they had a revolt, and they managed to kick the water company out, but that was the deal originally.
So are there, what the nations that are you aware of that the multinationals or the banks are investing in around water issues?
Well, I did read an article that said the Bush family, for example, owns a huge amount of land in South America, which is sitting right on top of huge aquifers, huge stores of water. And then you've got the big corporations. So you've got like Goldman Sachs is a big one. They always are. J.P. Morgan Chase. And where are they getting the money? They get it from they can now borrow extremely cheaply from the Federal Reserve because of the whole quantitative easing, which was supposed to generate money for loans for businesses and mortgages and so forth. In fact, it's just sitting there on the bank's books, and then they can use that as collateral for their repo loans, where they can borrow extremely cheaply, and they're buying up everything. In fact, I was tempted to write a book called The Plot to Own the World, which I think is, it may not be an actual plot, but that is the direction in which things are going. Everything's getting snatched up by these giant multinationals that have huge advantages over the rest of us. We can't borrow at 0.25% interest.
Well, when all that capital continues its rapid ascent to the top of the pyramid, what will the options be? I mean, it seems to me one is a revolution of some sort, the idea that people would create alternative currency, alternative capital sources. We're going to have to do something like that in order to afford things, aren't we? I mean, how does this thing play out?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to go local first. Form your little small communities that become self-sufficient if you've got enough resources to do that. And you do need to get your money out of those big banks because that's how they control us. That's how they're controlling Greece, for example. I mean, all those EU countries, the central bank can turn the spigot on and off at will, and all banks need the central bank as a backup because all banks are technically insolvent. I mean, they all lend out the same money that's supposedly there for their depositors when their depositors come for their money. So the first thing we need to do in the States is pull not only our private monies out of the local banks. I mean, that was tried in the Move Your Money campaign, but it didn't have a great impact because the banks weren't really dependent on that. I mean, it wasn't that much that moved, and the banks really weren't dependent on it. But if the state and local governments moved their money out and set up their own banks, then it wouldn't matter to us if the big Wall Street banks went down. I mean, they would not be too big to fail. We could let them fail like any other corporation in a capitalist system.
I know you're a California resident. Do you want to give any brief predictions on how you think your state's going to deal with running out of water?
Well, we've got a year, apparently, before our reservoirs run dry. And that's what prompted me to write this article, is that there have been hearings, and suddenly there's this great concern that there's no plan. We don't have a way to fix this problem. But they could drill some wells, according to Paul Power of the Primary Water Institute. You could drill enough wells across the country for less than $1 billion that would be able to provide the water for the whole state. And we saw that in Libya with the Libya's great man-made river project, where I think they dug 1,300 wells, and this was water coming out of rock in a place that was like totally desert. There was no way that was aquifer water because there's no place for it to collect. There are no mountains where it was, where it would rain and no rainfall would collect in that area. And it was water that came out of the rock. They put in 1,300 wells. They put in this great big pipeline, which was the man-made river project, and they used it to bring water to the cities and bring water to for agriculture. So they turned the deserts green until, of course, we went ahead and bombed that pipeline and the place where they, the factory where they make the pipes. So we pretty much destroyed that system. But anyway, that just shows what can be done. And in California, we could do the same thing. 1,300 wells would probably, I'm not sure the number of wells, but anyway, you could service the whole state for under $1 billion.
Well, that's a very hopeful sign. Maybe we should leave it there. But I want to encourage folks to read this article of yours just published, called California Water Wars, Another Form of Asset Stripping. I know your guest today, Roger Landry, has some interesting things to say about not just the water thing, but a variety of other components of story. So we'll get into that shortly. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay, thank you. My guest today is Roger Landry, the founder of the Liberty Beacon Project, a global organization consisting of over a dozen websites with contributors from over 30 countries and a radio network. Its declared mission is the eradication of programmed ignorance and the pushback against anything that harms humanity. A broad mission indeed. Roger spent over 30 years either in the military or working for it, including over 20 years working for the military-industrial complex, facilitating Department of Defense contracts. He is a fund of knowledge on many subjects with a unique perspective growing out of this long military experience. Greetings, Roger. It's great to be talking to you.
And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ellen.
Thank you. You interviewed me not very long ago, and we had a quite lively discussion on many things, so I thought I would take the opportunity to interview you. I've just been writing on something that's sort of not in my usual line, which is usually public banking, which is the California drought and the water wars that we've had for like over actually a century in this state. Like movies have been made about it, such as Chinatown with Faye Dunaway and Jack Nicholson. So we're now in a four-year drought, which experts say could go for 20 years or more. And they're fighting over the Delta water tunnels. That it's going to be hugely expensive, something like $60 billion, and it'll take years to get finished once they even decide to implement it. So there aren't really any solutions. And what I'm proposing is one solution that I've heard of, which is that they can actually drill for what's called primary water. Apparently, the new research shows that under the Earth's mantle, the crust, there's two to three times more water than is actually in the surface oceans. And we can tap that by in these places where there's volcanic fissures, that so the water comes is pushed up close to the ground, and there's ways to find it. And it wouldn't cost that much to put in wells like across the state to fix the problem. But those types of solutions, which are natural and relatively inexpensive, for some reason aren't explored. Like finding more water is not what they're looking for. It's just like finding more money is not what they're looking for. We have to fight over the existing money, and that's the purpose of the Federal Reserve and these other central banks. Are supposed to maintain the stability of the currency, which basically means you can't put any more money into the system. But we don't have enough money in the system, and that's what's wrong with it. And the same with water. We don't have enough water, but there are ways to actually find new water. So, which leads to the question, if you follow the money, who profits from suppressing these alternatives? And in fact, who profits from the drought? One, the organic farmers are supposedly going to take the biggest hit because they have to put their cows on grass-fed land, and there just isn't that much grass anymore. So then the obvious, you know, follow the money, that's Monsanto will profit from that because they can then push their GMO seeds on these farmers that can no longer raise cows on grass. And then there's the bottled water, the privatization of water, and the bottled water industry can profit and so forth. So anyway, then some people actually think that this is a man-made drought and that, again, there are either military purposes behind this, or there are perhaps it's just all big corporations that just greed has overcome the welfare of the people. Anyway, I know you have views on that, along with many other possible solutions to many, you know, the planets, the ills of the planet and the ills of the people that could be solved if we just promoted these innovative things that we know are out there, but they never get supported. They don't have the funding. If we had the funding, which we could get, for example, through public banking, we could arguably solve all these global problems. But let's start with water then, and the drought. So what do you think? Is the drought man-made? And if so, who did it and why, and what's the motivation?
Well, you have covered a big chunk of this already, but I do have a few things that I can interject into this point, at this point in the conversation. One of them being is that I've read several reports that California has less than a one-year supply of water left. And the biggest issue is not the fact that there's only 1 year of water left. The biggest issue is that nothing is being accomplished to follow this up. And you put that so eloquently. Do I believe that the California drought is being caused in part by man-made events? Yes, I do. And I don't want to go deeply into a geoengineering issue, but what I would say is that you can see on any given day if a front is moving towards California across the Pacific Ocean. When it gets about 800 to 1,000 miles off of the coast, all of a sudden you can clearly see in the satellite photos available to everybody the streaks being laid down in the upper atmosphere. And what you see blatantly is that within a 24-hour period, that storm either collapses in on itself or it is steered north so that it hits Oregon or Washington rather than the course it's been on for several thousand miles to hit California. Now, I'm not telling you that everything about drought is being caused by man-made efforts, because I don't actually believe that myself. California, over the last several hundred years, has been hit by several droughts. I would say that this is going to probably be the heaviest drought and the most involved when it comes to population, because the population of California today is far beyond what it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. So we're looking at affecting a massive portion of population. Do I believe that one of the answers is drilling for water that sits under the crust? Yes, I do. I also believe that if industry and scientific endeavor have been allowed to pour the money into the science of desalinization that has been poured into so many other projects, the cost of desalinization could have come down drastically. There are already communities on this planet that are drawing their water from salty oceans, and they are desalinizing this water for use amongst their public. And it is a possibility. And with all of the money that's been put into things like solar power, wind power, and other endeavors, we have seen the cost drop drastically. And the same approach could have been taken to desalinization. California has a huge coastline, and desalinization plants could have been set up all along the coast. There, you cannot tell me that climatologists and scientists have not been aware of the water issues in California for a very long time. But
so why do you think they don't? That's my question. What's the motive, and who's profiting? And
well, the profiting you pretty much discussed, okay? If we make it unprofitable for these natural farmers or these organic farmers to farm, they're going to go out of business. What you have is biotech companies like Monsanto and DuPont and other companies that are genetically modifying seeds to grow in more arid soil, in aluminum-saturated soil, something we won't even discuss at this point.
Wow.
But they are genetically modifying seeds so that they can grow them in the more arid climates, which California is definitely turning into. So what you have are monopolies or very, very large multinational cabals or corporations cornering the market and forcing the individual or the small farmer or the medium-sized farmer who works only for himself and his family out of business. Tens of thousands of farms have gone out of business nationwide in this country in the last few years due to biotech companies and the competition they represent. If we were to talk about GMOs, that would be a whole different subject and a whole different evil. So I won't delve into that deeply, but they are part of the reason. Yes, they will control a lot of the farmland in California. Most of your listeners might not be aware that over 60% of all of the fresh produce eaten in this country is grown and produced by the state of California. So if California drops off the map as a food-producing state, the entire country gets thrown into a tailspin, and this is happening. Now, you ask why. I will touch very lightly. Again, I don't want to throw conspiracy theories into your show, and they're not theories, they're conspiracy facts. Agenda 21 is a global issue being perpetrated and perpetuated by the United Nations. Part of their goal is to draw a massive portion of the public and the society away from the agrarian life they live and into what they call megacities. In order to do that, you must have a reason for these people to leave the countryside. If the countryside is no longer productive and can no longer support these families in this agrarian style, they have no choice but to move to a community where everything is centrally located, the mega cities. So between the greed of the mega corporations who wish to corner the food supply in this country, and Agenda 21, which wishes to draw the public, not only in California, but in every state in the United States, away from the countryside and centralize them into what they themselves term megacities. What you have is a force that the average Californian is pushing back against Goliath. And Goliath beyond what you can believe. Now, do I believe that the Californian people, if they unite their voices and unify their voices to push back against this, cannot make headway? I do believe they can. But you have to wake up enough people to create a critical mass to push back against this. We need to reach that critical mass. And Ellen, it's thanks to absolutely phenomenal shows like the one you're producing here today that allows us to increase those numbers until we reach that critical mass.
Yep, I totally agree. Thank you. And it's like shows like yours and websites like yours. I know you're quite interested in and know quite a bit about alternatives for medicine as well, which is something I wrote 10 books about before I started writing about banking.
Yes.
So, and those also are suppressed and not funded. The alternatives aren't funded. So do you have a few thoughts?
I have more than a few, but let me start it off with my punchline, and then we'll fill in the blanks after that. In most cases, a treatment for a debilitating or a fatal disease that is known and proven, a citizen of this country must leave the country in order to get this treatment, especially if we're talking about cancer. There are clinics just south of the border in Mexico who have a success rate of treating cancer over 95%. In this country, those methods, and some of them do include cannabis and other methods, those treatments in this country are illegal. So basically what we have is the cut, burn, and slash. Okay? If you have cancer, you can be poisoned with chemotherapy. You can go in and have organs cut out. Or you can go on drugs that will absolutely numb and kill your cognitive functions. These are the alternatives you have for a massive majority of cancer cases in this country. Yet you can go to Portugal, you can go to Spain, you can go to Mexico, and you can get treatments that have a success rate well over 90%. And these are illegal in this country. There is absolutely no excuse for that. But again, these are the monopolies of the large pharmaceutical companies. Now, why is this centered on the United States? Why is this illegal in the United States and legal in so many other countries? Well, let's put it into perspective. The United States is the most drugged nation on the planet by a huge margin. We take more psychotropic or psychiatric drugs than any other nation on the planet. If your child has, I don't know, issues whereby they're constantly interrupting the class, behavioral issues, there is a very good chance, above 75%, your child will be sent to a nurse who will recommend them to a counselor or a psychiatrist who will immediately put them on psychiatric or psychotropic drugs. We're talking about over 100 million Americans in a nation of a little over 300 million people who are on some form of mind-altering drug. And this is a monopoly that is controlled by the big pharmaceutical corporations. So there's your politics, there's your money, and the solution would be to allow these mechanisms of cure that we see in other countries that have these phenomenal success rates to be legalized in this country. But as soon as you do that, you immediately take huge amounts of funding away from these pharmaceutical companies. They have one of the largest lobbies in this country. And anybody who believes we live in a democratic society today needs to go to a recent study released by Princeton University that says, this is Princeton University stating, the United States is no longer ruled by a democratic process. It is ruled by an oligarchy or by corporations. So with the huge, massive power of the pharmaceutical lobby, a lot of what could provide very, very successful cures in this country is illegal through their very lobbying.
Wow, totally interesting. So there is also the matter of alternative energy systems, wind, solar, tidal, etc., that are also either being suppressed or just not developed, something that we could develop if we had the money to do it, which, of course, I'm all about things to save the planet and finding the funding to do it and whether there might actually be a motive for suppressing these things. So what do you think about alternative energies? I know you have some good ideas on that.
Well, again, we come back to the same point. What everybody's going to find out is that each and every subject you bring up, I can tie all back to the same people you're discussing as either stunting or preventing, okay? And again, we come to a huge money issue. I can go back to when I was a child, and I was born in 1954. I'm talking about in the middle 60s, a gentleman invented a carburetor that would increase, because back then cars got 10, 12 miles to the gallon on a good day, invented a carburetor that would get over 80 miles to the gallon. That was immediately bought up, and he was basically told that he had no right to pursue that line of research anymore due to the money that he was paid. It was bought up, it was shelved, it was never taken back off the shelf. We see this in so many aspects of energy today. I read several articles not too long ago about 3D printers that can print. You can actually print solar cells or solar panels in your own house, ribbon after ribbon after ribbon that you can put in a frame, put up, and produce your own solar power. Again,
This
is patented. Again, these are bought up. These concepts are bought up. These companies are bought up, and you never hear from it again. We're talking about so many different forms of energy that are non-polluting. You and I had a discussion not too long ago about tidal power, okay, whereby you harness by buoying or anchoring to the bottom of the ocean pumps that the rise and fall of the waves would move pistons, which would turn generators, which would produce electricity with zero impact on the ecology or the ecosystem. And once they're up and running, the only cost is the maintenance, okay? You don't have to feed them fuel like coal-burning power plants. You don't have to feed them fuel like oil-burning power plants. You don't have to put humanity at stake such as you do in nuclear power plants. This is very clean, very practical, just like the desalinization plants that they've poured absolutely no money into at bringing the cost down. So there are multiple mechanisms for producing power, but again, they are controlled by, bought up by, and kept from the public by those who stand to lose the most. And who stands to lose the most? The coal industry, the oil industry, the nuclear industry. They don't want this competition. They don't want you producing your own power and going off the grid, because every citizen who does that knocks their profit margin down. Can you imagine everybody in California printing their own solar cells, and the only time they actually need power maybe for a couple of hours a day, or unless they've got a battery system that they put in, never needing power from the main grid again? All right, now you're stealing money from big oil, you're stealing money from big coal, and you're stealing money from the nuclear industry. These people will not put up with it. And the only way we're going to change that, again, is to reach a critical mass of citizens who say, I don't want to breathe poison air. I don't want to drink poison water anymore. And I don't want to pay you for something I can do myself. We need to reach that critical mass. And Ellen, it's thanks to absolutely phenomenal shows like the one you're producing here today that allows us to increase those numbers until we reach that critical mass.
It's been really great talking to you, Roger. My guest today has been Roger Landry, whose website is thelibertybeacon.com. That's like Liberty Beacon, like all one word, so thelibertybeacon.com.
Lately, Wall Street interests have started to pay attention to the numerous regional locations where public banking initiatives are gaining momentum, as they begin to realize that folks are getting wise to the financial and democratic costs of our dependence on Wall Street borrowing for everything we need. It's a hugely costly and unnecessary expense that public banks can potentially stanch, at least for purposes of public investment. One recent foray by the Cato Institute received a thorough review by our commentator Matt Standard, who reflects on their claims as part of this week's Public Banking Report.
The state of Abraham Lincoln and Barack Obama has become the latest state this year to get a public bank bill on the floor of the legislature. Meanwhile, this nationwide forward movement in public banking isn't making Wall Street interests very happy. They're pushing back. But do they have the skills to pay the bills? Hi, I'm Matt Standard with your Public Banking Report. After advancing in Maine, New Hampshire, and Arizona, to name only a few states where public banks are currently on the agenda, public banking has advanced to the ruminations of the General Assembly in Illinois. This is something state representatives have tried to do a few times. This time, it has actually made it to the General Assembly docket. The legislation is the Community Bank of Illinois Act, sponsored by Representative Mary Flowers. It provides that state funds must be deposited in the bank. There are provisions concerning the guarantee of deposits and the bank's role as a clearinghouse, the authorization of loans from the General Revenue Fund, and the legislative language even provides for loans to farmers. The bill was assigned to the Financial Institutions Committee, which met on March 10th, where it passed out of committee and will be considered in the general legislative session. Amara Enyea, organizer and former mayoral candidate in Chicago and a longtime supporter of public banking, offered decisive testimony in front of that committee. Always thinking strategically, Dr. Enyea told PBI afterwards that it was instructive hearing the opposition arguments. She concluded, "We are well positioned to refute their claims within the context of how the bank would affect Illinois and the state's economy." After the session, we had good conversations, she said, about strategic moves that will continue to advance this. I'm excited about the next steps. Well done, Amara Enyea. Well done, Representative Flowers, who has agreed to give us an interview for our next episode. And well done, Illinois Public Banking Movement. As always, there were many others involved, and it takes a real team effort for a movement to get something like this onto the legislative floor. But it was inevitable that in the face of the most momentous rush towards public banks in recent memory, with actual public banks on the agenda, and we mean hotly on the agenda in over 10 states, and campaigns about to make it happen in many more, it was inevitable that big Wall Street interests would push back. The big private banks support think tanks, well-funded ones, as you might imagine, and their hired guns have been working overtime to try to stick holes in the arguments for public banks. The Cato Institute, which calls itself libertarian, but accepts money from a lot of big financial institutions who like the rule regime as it stands now, the Cato Institute often leads the think tank charge against public banking, and this month has been no exception, with Mark Calabria, who's debated for Cato against public banks in the past, penning a couple of articles in American Banker and elsewhere, charging that government involvement in banks is bad. And that's just the problem right there. Articles like his fail to distinguish between various types of banks, citing data and evidence long out of date against the here and now formulations for new public banks. Mr. Calabria cited articles he said indicted public banks, while the authors of those studies explicitly said otherwise. His research simply did not apply to the BND or the types of banks PBI and its allies envision. What he considered a government-owned bank is not a BND-style public bank, but rather any bank where the government has a shareholding exceeding 20% of total shares. His inference was that the government banks suffer from political interference, while there's simply no evidence of that at the Bank of North Dakota, which is now almost 100 years old. Rather, more recent research consistently reaches optimistic conclusions about publicly owned banks, whether in Germany or Switzerland or Costa Rica. A robust global profile of the success of public banking around the world is clearly visible. The public banking movement seeks to create public financial institutions that responsibly support community-oriented private ones. And we have numerous good models, some dating back 200 years, that prove that they work. Indeed, this week, Paul Buchheit of usagainstgreed.org wrote in Nation of Change, the Public Bank of North Dakota had an equity return of 23.4% before the state's oil boom. The normally privatization-minded Wall Street Journal admits that the BND's costs are extremely low. No exorbitantly paid executives, no bonuses, no fees, no commissions, only one branch office, very low borrowing costs. On the other side of the ledger, thanks to private banks, interest claims $1 out of every $3 we spend, as evidenced by the fact that by the time we retire, over half the value of our 401ks are lost to the banks that we got them from due to interest and fees. The real difference between public and private banks. That's our public banking report for this episode of It's Our Money. I'm Matt Standard, reminding you of the words of Alice Walker. Activism is the rent I pay for living on the planet. See you next time, and keep paying that activist rent. Together we'll fix this economy. After all, it's our money.
Now we're going to get some bracing perspective from the most outspoken American critic, the late, great George Carlin, who whom our recent guest Paul Craig Roberts quoted as accurately describing the insular control of the oligarchy that we've been discussing on today's program. Carlin describes control of our country as a big club, in language that, I must warn you, is very adult, so take a 3-minute break if you're easily offended. Truth is, our debt-enslaved situation is deeply offensive, so Carlin's caustic language perhaps fits. But when he did this routine several years ago, it may have sounded to some a bit like a paranoid overworking of the American predicament as citizens. But these days, he's making complete sense, as illustrated by the earlier discussions on this program.
But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back. So they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it.
As you heard from Matt, the idea of creating public banks as a direct result of the bad behavior, criminal excesses, and lost wealth to the hands of the Wall Street firms has been gaining ground in the U.S. But as a listener to this show, you of course know that that momentum is truly international. From Iceland to Greece, despairing citizens are looking for some relief from the austerity practices that have undermined prospects for decent and sustainable lives. So initiatives now underway in Ireland, Canada, and Greece all make interesting stories to follow. And for the inside scoop on these developments, we have our own Ellen Brown to talk with.
But I thought that the Bank of Canada thing was interesting because it's resurfaced, and it seems now that our friend Rocco Galati feels like this
No, I actually met him. He's a friend. Okay. I met him in Canada. Yep.
He's really got he's on a roll. Do you have any thoughts about where that's going now and what that means? It's, I think people are starting, even though there's been a media blockout of the coverage of this story of the Canadians for economic and monetary reform, have made this significant step into reclaiming the law that was written for the country to allow the bank to issue debt-free money to governments, to Canadian governments. Now they've won their latest appeal. Now where is this headed, Ellen? What's going to happen next, do you think?
Well, the appeal kept them from getting kicked out of court. You know, it was an appeal of a motion, or I think it was a demurrer, to saying basically that the pleadings failed to state a cause of action. That was brought by the government, and the government lost. So now the plaintiffs are allowed to go forward with their case, but their case is quite strong, it seems to me, that that the Bank of Canada's mandate is to serve the country, and that they're allowed to print money in order to lend to the government interest free, and that they should do that. That it's a violation of their mandate for this government to borrow from private banks. Although I'm not quite sure why that is a suit against the Bank of Canada. I mean, I don't think it's the Bank of Canada refusing to lend. It's the government refusing to borrow. But I haven't looked all that closely to see what.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, let's say the government of Canada did do that. What kind of precedent is there for powers to push back against the Bank of International Settlements, which fostered this arrangement back in 1974? What kind of success has there been pushing back against the BIS?
Well, the Bank of International Settlements, that was the Basel Committee in 1974 came out with the it was just a directive saying that countries should maintain the value of their currencies, which basically meant don't generate extra money, don't print money, don't borrow from your own central bank, which would be, in effect, printing money because you're borrowing money that's been printed by the central bank. But what they're not recognizing is that all banks create money, and that's what the Bank of England just came out and said, that banks do not lend their deposits, they create the money they lend, or they create deposits in the process of making loans. So if the Bank of England acknowledges that all banks create money, clearly the more intelligent thing to do is for the government to borrow directly from its own bank, which it owns, and therefore it gets to keep the interest. So it seems to me it's just a matter of time before people wake up to the logic of this, except
right.
for the fact that we know that certainly in the U.S., Wall Street owns the government, as different politicians have said, and I assume it's the same in Canada.
Well,
so they have to break through that, but they also just have to break through the ignorance or the lack of understanding of how banking works.
We've been talking on this show about water as an example of a commodity that's becoming increasingly controlled by the monetary interests or the monopolist interests. Is there a prospect or possibility that the BIS would say, well, you know, we don't want any, we don't want this to become a multinational activity where nations start to reclaim the control of their own currency once again? We want them to continue to borrow from us. Do they have the kind of commodity control that they could say to Canada, well, look, if you're going to generate your own cash, we're not going to let you play in the world markets. You know, it's not going to trade with us. Does the BIS have that kind of ability to constrain government leaders from taking a radical step like that through market controls?
I don't think so. That would be a good question to look into it. I mean, certainly in the Eurozone, those countries have agreed to the Maastricht Treaty, which means they're forced to only borrow from the European Central Bank. And if they want a backstop, that's what they have to do, and they have to go along with the ECB's mandate. But the Bank of Canada, well, the Bank of Canada is part of the system. It's just a question of whether you can get the Bank of Canada to understand that it would be better for the bank, better for the people, better for the government to do it a different way. But I don't think there's actual regulatory control in this. I don't know that there are any consequences for doing it a different way, except maybe you might worry about your credit rating. Somebody might say that the country was printing money and therefore...
Because they set the credit ratings. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Now, what kind of impact then, you know, if in Ireland now, our friends in Ireland, setting up a new central bank, is that right? They have a new building, but isn't there's inquiry there about creating a public central bank in Ireland, right? In Ireland.
Well, what I know about that they're really moving on is setting up local public banks that would be on the Sparkasm model. So they're actually owned by the community and serving the community. Or they're not really owned by anyone. I think they're a nonprofit, just kind of like, you know, nonprofits aren't owned by anybody. They just have a board and a...
And then quickly moving over to Greece, we're in this kind of a limbo period where they've got to come up with some way to satisfy the ECB's demands for paying off their debt. Meanwhile, they're, you know, do we know anything about their budding affair possibly with the... With Russia.
It looks to me like they're holding their cards pretty close to the vest. They've got 4 months to work something out. I mean, they could at the end of 4 months just say, "All right, you guys are being unreasonable, so we're out, and we're going to set up our own currency. We're going to borrow from the Russia." But
yeah.
As far as I know, they haven't given off signals on what they're planning to do. I saw a cool article by what's his name. The finance minister.
Oh, yeah, Yanis Varoufakis.
Oh, yeah, Varoufakis, that they could create money like Bitcoin money. In other words, they could they could use algorithm. They could do a digital algorithm like Bitcoin, although it wouldn't be Bitcoin, where they would basically be monetizing future taxes, which is the same as... they did in the Middle Ages where with the tally sticks, where they were essentially monetizing. It was an advance against future taxes, and then you would get some sort of discount. So if you paid $80, you'd get $100 rebate on your taxes. So they could do that and generate their own money supply, and it seems to me they could do that without even really calling it. They don't have to give it a different name. I mean, they could do that with euros because they're generating an advance against a future debt in euros. So they would be still expanding the money supply because they don't need the euro coins. All they're doing, it's like fractional reserve lending where they're generating more credit than they actually have to back it all up.
Well, we need to wrap this up at this point, but it's certainly it's such an interesting time to be alive to watch what's happening to the latter stages of the evolutionary process of centralized and globalized money markets. Because as Paul Craig Roberts said on our show last week, the only way this travesty of policy is going to end is when it crashes, is when it fails. And I think that we might be finding that what will quickly replace it will be the creativity of, as you say, local communities and technology to allow people to get back in the game of having currency serve the needs of humanity. Ellen, this has been great, and we'll just have to tell everybody we'll see them next time, right?
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Rob.
Take care.
Great job.
Yep. Thank you, Ellen.
That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.